Hello, and welcome to Radio New Internationalist. Each week in this program, New Internationalists from around the world explore the people, the ideas, and the action in the fight for global justice. In a moment, campaigners from Colombia and the United States will start dropping in. They'll be taking us inside the minds of criminal countries. Why are modern-day governments going to war? How the people let them? And who's in the background cheering for blood? I'm Chris Richards from New Internationalist magazine. Stories celebrating human rights are this program's bread and butter. Unquestionably, the most gross violation of human rights occur in times of war, not just because of the mass slaughter, unspeakable rapes and torture, and unestimable injuries. Everything that we value is under attack. Homes and schools, family, friends and food, political debate, participation in government, protection by the rule of law. And as we probed in last week's program, the effects of conflict reverberate for decades, even centuries, as the legacy of violence is inherited from one generation to the next. So it goes without saying that when war knocks on the door of a country, human rights fly out the window. The good news is that major armed conflict causing at least 1,000 deaths within a year, is falling. The bad news is that it doesn't seem that way. The United States, hell-bent on removing global risks to its economic and social security, is aggressively intervening in the Middle East, Central Asia, and Latin America. This is not new. What is new is the amount of countries that have actively supported the waging of war. So, here at Radio New Internationalist, we're wondering why Western world countries that are gloriously free from internal conflict are nevertheless sending armed troops out into the world to fight. Generally speaking, how is the support for war in a faraway place built and maintained? Who figures out its foundations? And what are the pillars that prop it up? Setting out some of the answers today are two passionate advocates speaking internationally against war and for human rights. One from a country that promotes war and another that is a victim of it. First, I'm delighted to be speaking with Kathy Black from the United States. She's a convener of the organisation Labour Against the War. She's in Melbourne as part of the New Western Front to Stop the War. And the war she's wanting to stop is, you guessed it, the one in Iraq. First of all, Kathy, tell us why you're travelling in Australia at the moment.
Well, I've been invited over by the Stop the War Coalition in Sydney, and through their contacts in the peace movement around the country, they organized a national speaking tour. And they reached out to me for a number of reasons. One, they tell me that they think it helps for Australians to hear that it's not disloyal to your American friends to oppose the war, that there are millions of Americans also opposed to the war and working against it, and that we welcome the alliance with the peace movements in other countries. And specifically reached out to our organization, which now represents about 200 affiliated union groups who represent about 3 million workers, so that I could bring the message to union members and union leaders here in Australia. Apparently, your union movement is light years ahead of ours in terms of opposition to foreign policy historically. Took positions against the Vietnam War and against apartheid and have been very actively opposed to many foreign policy positions of your government. Historically, in the States, that really hasn't been the case. And in fact, our union movement, which is progressive on most social and economic justice issues, has really been way too close to our administration, whether it was Democrat or Republican, or good times or bad, on foreign policy issues. In fact, I'm ashamed to say, has been aligned with the CIA on more than one occasion and backed really the wrong sides of union struggles, not with management against unions, but when there's been splits in union movements, especially in third world countries. They've sometimes backed the sides that were much more aligned with the oppressive government.
And when you're talking about Labour being aligned with the CIA, I suppose that you're talking mostly about Latin America at the moment?
But Africa also, certainly in Southern Africa, South Africa specifically, and other places as well. But yes, Latin America, I think, is where our greatest involvement has been. That's been the history in the past, and my organization has worked very hard to change that policy.
I'm really interested in the fact that you talk about the war. because there's wars happening all over the world at the moment, and America has chosen to intervene in this one, but not, say, for instance, in Sudan, where there was bloodshed left, right and centre, but an issue that wasn't central to US interests at that time as predominantly as oil in Iraq is, although oil is one of the major resources in Sudan also.
Yes, it's surprising they haven't gone after that oil. Yeah, I am talking about the war because my organization was really created. We were born in response to this war. And we know it's not the only war, but we have limited resources and ability to organize. And frankly, our government did more than intervene in this war. They created this war. There would be no war without us. And there would be no war if George Bush hadn't been elected president, no matter what happened on 9/11.
Indeed. And what I'd like to do now is look at some of the pillars that are supporting that war effort in the US. Let's take religion first. It's a sensitive issue, I know, but the fundamentalist right in the US seems to have been one of the driving forces behind this war. What is its position and what influence do you think it has had on the US administration at the moment?
The fundamentalist Christian right has pretty much supported everything George Bush has done. Now, they, mind you, haven't been thoroughly happy with him, and there's some backlash against him now, not so much, well, somewhat about the war as well. I mean, the war is now unpopular with 70% of the people, and so that has to include some of the Christian right
as
well.
That's enormous, isn't it?
That is absolutely enormous, and when you think that it took really a decade after the beginning of the Vietnam War before we had that kind of opposition, it's really ramped up rather quickly this time. So the Christian right, it's a big and complicated issue. There's been some new leaders in the Christian right that are emerging. Of course, a lot of the old leaders are now in jail or disgraced for one reason or another. They turned out to be quite corrupt. And that Pat Robertson, he's not in jail, but he's been quite discredited because he's just made so many absurd remarks, such hateful remarks and, you know, name-calling, and blamed 9/11 on abortion rights activists and lesbian and gay people and feminists. In other words, it's the sins of the United States that caused this horror to be visited on our people. It was God's punishment for our many sins. Frankly, some of their followers are pretty nuts, too. That didn't really sit well with a lot of people, and it largely discredited them in the bigger population. But there's some new leaders who are really disenchanted with the actions of the Christian right. They're still ministers. They're still very religious. They're not going to come to agreement with the left on abortion rights or some other things. But they feel that the mission and the message of Christianity has really been distorted by many of these ministers. And the blind following of the Bush administration, no matter where they lead, is of concern to them. So they've taken on a lot of more Christian ministry type of work that you would ordinarily associate with religious organizations, you know, around poverty and disease overseas and in our country. And so there's been a little bit of shift there, and some of the worst elements are going away.
So that pillar might be folding a little bit.
I hope it's folding. It's definitely diminished in importance and even in voting importance. They're not as dependable voters for the right in the last election in 2006, not the last presidential election, but our last big congressional elections. They either didn't come out at all because they were disenchanted with Bush and the Republican Party, or there was some crossover voting as well among that population. In 2004, they were motivated to come out because Karl Rove, the chief political strategist under Bush, worked very hard to promote the hot-button religious issues that are guaranteed to motivate that population. And he did that especially in the big swing states like Ohio, which turned out to be the pivotal state in that election. Not all of our states have this right, but many have the opportunity to have initiative, referendum, and recall items put on the state ballots. And Ohio is one of them. And so they mounted all these anti-gay marriage initiatives on ballots in states where they knew that Christian right voters were disenchanted and they needed a reason to motivate them to come to the polls. So once they got them to come to the polls on an issue like that, they weren't going to be voting for John Kerry at the same time. They also voted for Bush. And the conservative estimate is that they turned out an extra 4 million voters.
On that alone?
On that alone.
On actually driving a much more conservative agenda politically in other areas, they got 4 million votes.
That's
in
right.
Ohio. That's amazing.
Well, not all in Ohio, nationwide, but a critical margin in Ohio, and it was a razor-thin victory in Ohio. It was another one of those extra 24 hours till they had a final count.
The other religious aspect to this war is evident in the neocons who supported it, and I'm talking here about people like Richard Perle and Paul Wolfowitz, both Jewish men. I'm wondering what the Jewish lobby has said about this war and what their support and leaning on the administration has been?
Well, I can't speak real authoritatively about that. I would say that the Jewish community is not unilateral on this question. The Zionist community, I imagine, has been relatively close to the Bush administration and supported the foreign policy. But the Jewish community covers a broad political spectrum. You know, the Wolfowitz and Pearl folks and Cheney, frankly, this policy to invade Iraq, they've been talking about this for many years. And so it's not all about Israel. I'm sure that that's an element, but I think really control of Middle East resources and Iraq's oil has been clearly a plan of theirs for many years. You know, it's been all written up, sitting on a shelf, waiting for the opportune moment to bring it out and bamboozle the American people into believing that it was in their interests for some completely unrelated reason. And 9/11, they picked that as their opportune moment. They talked about it right away.
Are you talking here about the Project for the New American Century?
That's right, yes.
And that document that was done in the 90s,
yes,
that actually became the blueprint for war on Iraq later on?
That's right.
Yes, it was amazing. I mean, how did that wash with the American psyche? You had 9/11, of course. Most of the people involved with that were Saudi Arabians.
Right.
And nevertheless, the jump was made in the American psyche to actually invade Iraq. And it worked here too. I never got it.
Mm-hmm.
How did that play out, do you think?
Americans generally are not complex thinkers, and 99% of Americans conservatively don't know anything about the plan for the new American century or any of this backstory. Americans were just blinded with revenge and anger and misery, and were just prepared to follow their leader, who they viewed as strong and going to go out and do the right thing, catch the evildoers, and revenge the death. And weren't looking very closely at it. And Americans are willing to be led. They're not deep thinkers, you know. A lot of people very poor, working 2 and 3 jobs, feel disenfranchised, don't pay attention at all, or just willing to look at the headlines. And so there was a vast disinformation campaign that was carried out by the Bush administration. And it wasn't always direct lies. You know, maybe he even believed there were weapons of mass destruction. Who knows? But there were frequent circumstances where Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein would be mentioned in the same sentence. Even if he didn't say anything about them that really linked them together, he would just, you know, just blurt out a compound sentence and both their names would be in it. And that would be enough for most Americans to connect them. He would do that repeatedly, even in the same speech. But even besides that, a recent report came out by a couple of independent journalist organizations that documented 1,000 actual falsehoods, not just this obfuscation and generalization, but really lies that came out of this administration, either in writing or verbally, that they knew were lies.
That they knew were lies.
That they knew were
intentionally.
Lies. Intentionally misleading
now,
Americans, yes.
Can I just ask, that must have been a document tracking of major proportions to actually get that
figure.
Yeah,
I mean, this is a serious research project to go through the public record over the last 5 years and document this kind of thing. Now, generally, I think Americans have all reached that conclusion anyway, whether they knew about the 1,000 documented falsehoods or not. Many of the lies have been exposed. And besides the outright lies, Americans are just mortified at many of the other things that have come to light in the course of this war. The torture at Abu Ghraib, detention without trial and charges and Guantanamo.
Rendition.
All the, you know, the violations of civil liberties that we think we value so highly. The treatment of our own veterans. I mean, this is probably what's outraged Americans the most. There was a huge expose in the Washington Post late last year, about a 7-part series, I think, about just horrific conditions in our flagship veterans hospital. Wounds that were killing soldiers in previous wars, they're surviving now, but they're coming home. And they were just finding the crumbling facilities, leaking pipes, rusty water, just disgraceful, disgraceful conditions, long, long waiting lists for treatment. So if anything make Americans angry, it's mistreatment of their veterans. And so that was really a very big deal.
One more nail in the administration's coffin, so to speak.
Yes, yes. It's a wonder he can breathe still. But
you're listening to Radio New Internationalist. I'm Chris Richards, sitting in community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. And today, we're taking a look at how support for war is built, who builds its foundations, and what are the pillars that prop it up with Kathy Black, a convener of the United States organisation Labour Against the War. Kathy, let's move on to one of the other pillars that are supporting this war at the moment, which is the intelligence on which America went into the war. I'm astounded that American intelligence wouldn't have said to the administration at the time, look, if you go into Iraq, you're going to be there for not just years, probably a decade or more. And the reason for that is that the whole country is going to collapse and there will be a civil war within the country. Our magazine was actually reporting that at the time with people we had on the ground, and we had hardly anybody on the ground. I can't believe that the CIA and other people advising the government wouldn't have said the same thing. Is it something that's intentional, or is it just gross negligence?
Well, hubris is the first word that comes to mind for me. I mean, that swaggering, pompous Donald Rumsfeld assured us that the war would be over in 6 weeks, 6 months at the most, and called it a cakewalk. And of course, now we know that there were people in the Intelligence Committee who were fearful of raising these issues, but did raise these issues and say that it wasn't going to be that easy and that there were other eventualities and possibilities were out there. There's been a number of generals who have retired in the course of this war and come out and been bitterly critical of the way the war has been waged and the fact that it was waged at all. Why weren't their voices listened to when they were still in command and should have been listened to? Bush likes to say that he takes his direction from the commanders on the ground, the generals on the ground. Again, I go back to the word hubris and the belief that might makes right, that the American military is invincible, that these are just, you know, poor Arabs and we were going to be able to overrun them. And they clearly did no planning for any kind of endgame. I mean, you know, this is all beside the point that they never should have been there in the first place. Frankly, in terms of the American public's response, it's another mistreatment of the military. You know, you send these troops in there. They were improperly equipped. You know, their parents were sending them pieces of scrap metal for body armor for their vehicles. And I think that the fact that there was so little planning, no real thought about the consequences for our troops on the ground was just horrifying to military families and the American public.
There might have been another reason, though. Huge resources have been pumped into the military administration at all levels and the armaments trade in America. Indeed, there is an argument that your economy wouldn't survive at the moment if it wasn't for the war, that there is so much money being pumped into it now. It's such a large percentage of the GDP that it is necessary now to sustain.
But that's not our money. We borrowed that money from China. We already spend 51% of our budget on the military. That doesn't even count all these supplemental appropriation bills that have been passed in the last couple of years, which really are close to $200 billion apiece. Another one now proposed for this spring, $197 billion that Bush wants. That's not part of our actual budget that's already been passed by the Congress, but would be a supplemental appropriation on top of that. Well, where is that money coming from? We've been in a deficit now for the last few years. Our economy is tanking. Nothing's propping up our economy. It is really dropping quickly. People are losing their houses every week. 63,000 Americans lost their jobs last month. And, you know, even though we had a very healthy surplus in our budget when Bush came into office, we now owe $400 billion to China, our largest economic competitor. That's who's funding this war. Now, when they look at the condition of the American dollar right now, they might not be real thrilled to hold that debt. So certainly the major corporations that produce armaments and aircraft and that kind of thing are benefiting no matter where the money's coming from. And those are Bush's number one clients. They're the people that have propped him up all this time.
Has any assessment been done about what could have been done with that money had it have been spent
on? Oh, thank you for that question. It's actually something that my organization is working on right now. The unmet needs for the Americans are huge. The rest of the westernized countries all have better social safety nets than we do, all have greater percentage of their budget spent on public needs than we do. And it's not hard to see. You can take a tour of any inner city in our country, and the needs are quite glaring. The increasing gap between the rich and the poor, the more hours that people are working, the greater productivity and how much less they're seeing for those kind of gains in their real income than used to be the case. $137 billion we spent last year alone, $720 million a day. These are numbers I've said enough times that I feel confident with them. $720 million a day, $137 billion in 2007 alone, would have built 22,000 elementary schools, for instance. And in the inner cities, it's a wonder any child can learn anything in the schools that they're in. They are just crumbling edifices, really ancient, decrepit plumbing, very scarce supplies. thousands of university scholarships. We don't have free public university in our country. It's mostly private. Some of it's subsidized state, but there's still tuition fees for every student. 39 million adult Americans could be provided with health insurance for the cost of 1 year of this war. We have 47 million Americans with no health insurance.
Heavens, that's a huge statistic, isn't it?
It's gigantic, and it's growing rapidly.
Yes.
You know, it's grown by many millions over the Bush years. It was bad enough when Clinton was president, and now all these years have gone by and things have just gotten worse. Health insurance is very much tied to employment in the States, and so now we're in an economic downturn. We're in a recession, really, and people are losing their jobs, so that means they lose their health insurance as well. And Bush even opposed, even while he's passing tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans and for corporations, he went absolutely against any expansion of health care for uninsured children. Uninsured children. 58 million uninsured children could be covered with the expenditure for 1 year's war. So these numbers are so important because Americans, they have to think about things in concrete terms. It has to be brought down to their household budget, their jobs, their needs, and it's a graphic way to do it.
Absolutely. And that's another really big reason why the US was able to go into the war, the psyche of the American public itself. It's a big pillar supporting the war effort in the US. I've always found it interesting that America, I learned this at school myself, has or had an isolationist policy, that it wasn't going to meddle in the affairs of others, just as China says it is now. And in both cases, America more particularly than China, because America was much more active at it, America was in with its CIA in Latin America, across Europe, in Africa, fomenting trouble and conflict.
Oh, absolutely. Disgraceful things.
Why is that not taught in your schools?
Well, I don't think it's something to be proud of. It's always been covert action, and it's not really talked about much even in the media. I mean, there's much in our schools that isn't taught. I'm a union activist. There's certainly nothing about regular working people's history taught in our schools, or very little. And isolationists, you know, Bush ran on an isolationist platform in 2000, absolutely against nation building. We're not going to have any more of this democratic meddling in other countries and nation building. We're going to rebuild our own country. Well, you know, and then the first opportunity, that's exactly what he went after, although actually nation building isn't really what he's after. He's really after the oil. And actually, that's one of the things that I'm talking about. It's one of the biggest messages I'm trying to bring to the union leaders.
I think that that message has been sold now, Kathy. Are you finding that in the people you talk with?
I'm finding that people are receptive to that message and believe it, but they don't know much about the details. And largely at the request of the Iraqi trade union leaders themselves, who we've forged very strong links with, and they have a twofold message to us, and this is what we've acted on. One is that they have no labor rights themselves, and that goes back to the Hussein days. In the late 80s, Saddam Hussein passed a couple of laws that outlawed union organizing in the public sector, which is more than two-thirds of their economy and, of course, includes the oil sector. And so it meant that, at best, there'd be a very weak union movement. And those laws are still in the books. When Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority came to Baghdad, he was the Iraq administrator before the first parliament was elected, and he was appointed by George Bush to run the interim government. Took a good look at the Iraqi legal code and decided most of it was crap and that they could rewrite it much better, except for two laws that happened to outlaw unions in the public sector. He decided, well, Saddam got something right, and so those laws were worth preserving, and they stayed on the books, and they're still there now. The new Iraqi parliament, despite the organizing of the workers, has not relented and overturned those laws. So they're looking for basic union rights. We've organized around that in our country, and they're pushing for Iraq to sign on to the International Labor Organization's multi-point set of standards for workers' rights in all countries. We'd like the U.S. to sign on to all of them as well, as a matter of fact. And then the other piece that they're asking for our help in amplifying the message and building support is to expose the U.S.'s hands behind the scene in trying to orchestrate the privatization of the Iraqi oil industry. And the oil union workers are in the forefront of the civil opposition to those laws.
They've been magnificent, actually.
They have been magnificent. They get arrested, their union halls get invaded, and their computers and equipment gets confiscated, and their bank accounts get frozen, and they're harassed, and in some cases been assassinated. I think we've documented 650 incidents of some kind of harassment of union leaders, up to and including assassinations.
But by the Iraqi administration, supported by the U.S.?
From a variety of sources, sometimes militias, death squads, but certainly in some cases U.S. forces. U.S. forces killed at least one union leader. It's not clear that it was an assassination. And then the Iraqi government certainly complicit in this as well. So the oil workers, their position is it's always been a publicly owned industry. It's obviously the underpinning of the whole Iraq economy, their greatest resource, their only hope of rebuilding a civil society, a functioning society, which they don't have now, is those revenues. And they know perfectly well how to drill the oil, refine the oil, distribute the oil. They don't need private investment to do so. They don't need multinational oil corporations to come in and do so. So they're opposing very valiantly those privatization laws. But yeah, what I'm finding is most people don't know about those privatization laws. They don't know that the Bush administration and his cronies and his consulting pals actually wrote the language. So we've been trying to amplify that message, but we've had very little help from the corporate press. They really have to dig deep in alternative press sources to find details about the Iraqi actions or the details of the privatization schemes.
Which is a great segue into another pillar that's supporting the invasion of Iraq and the maintenance of the war, which is the media. Even if the American public was inward-looking and not prone to actually analyse what was going on in its name outside its own country, you would have thought that the American media would have got up there and actually blown the trumpet. They are starting to do that now, but just as they did in Vietnam, there was a silence surrounding this, definitely a support for the administration in actually going to war and maintaining a war, a moral crusade kind of tone to the articles.
Yes.
Why? Some of these people are fine journalists.
That's true. They are fine journalists. The only answer I have is that they're controlled by the corporations that they work for. It's a shrinking number of companies that we have in the mainstream media market now in the States. They're all owned by GM or GE or Disney, Sony. They're all major corporate conglomerates now. And in fact, our Federal Communication Commission has been trying very hard to ease up the rules so that they can control even more markets, more media outlets, and newspaper, TV, and radio in the same communities. You know, there's been a big backlash against that. But, I mean, it's already extreme to begin with. And those are the same corporations that give big money and lobby heavily at the Bush administration. And so there's a symbiotic relationship there. And so I think there's been a self-muzzling by the corporations and therefore their reporters. I mean, luckily, we live in an age where we've got community radio and we've got a lot of internet. There's a lot of other sources of news. You have to still be willing to work to find it and look for it. And I don't think most Americans are doing that. But I'm surprised to hear you say that the American media is doing better. They should have been much more helpful.
They should have been, yes.
Could have turned earlier. And frankly, mostly when I read about the oil laws in the mainstream media in the States, the talk is about the benchmark laws. These are four of the 18 benchmark laws that Bush keeps talking about that the parliament has to get passed in order to show that they're grown-ups now and that they can be trusted to run their own country, and maybe then we can consider withdrawing and let the children take over. But very little analysis of what those laws are or why they're not passing. It's just, you know, it's about distribution of the oil revenues. Well, yes, but really the bigger thing that it's about is the future exploration and discovery and development of oil fields. And there's new speculation actually that there may be much greater reserves there than originally thought. So, and those would go to the foreign oil conglomerates for up to 30 years. And the Iraqis know this much better than anybody in the United States or anybody in the media, in the mainstream media that's reporting it. And they're the ones that are opposing it. So I don't see that in the States. What we hear is that Well, the Iraqi parliament just can't get it together. You know, they're full of warring factions, and they're new at this democracy stuff. They don't have it down yet, and they just can't agree on anything. And but the truth is, you know, they're already politicians. They've been elected, some of them twice, and they know that they're not going to hold office and keep that power if they betray the Iraqi people, who know perfectly well that oil is their national resource and they don't want it privatized.
It seems also to me that in terms of the media, this embedding of media has worked a treat. Mm-hmm. In terms of Vietnam, one of the things that swung it around were pictures of the war, and we're just not seeing that.
No, we see nothing. The Bush administration prohibited the photographing of coffins returning.
Coffins of American...
of American soldiers, yes, being unloaded from the big transport planes for burial here in the country. I mean, they're very stirring, they're very emotional photos, and they just wanted to keep the American people as remote and distant from this war as they possibly could.
I wonder how our friends who are listening can get in contact with people, the faces of Iraq, in a more clear way. I was struck recently by a campaign in about October or November last year in America when noises were being made about Iran, and one organization had set up a phone booth on the streets.
Yes, that's right.
And was allowing anybody who passed to pick up the phone and talk to somebody in Iran. And
yeah,
I thought it was brilliant.
Yes, that's right. I saw that report too. That was a really creative and unique way to run a program like that. I haven't seen it replicated. I think in the peace movement in the U.S., at least, our connections with the Iraqis in U.S. labor against the war are relatively unique. The war is remote for most Americans, but even in the peace movement, there's not a lot of human faces that are connecting across the thousands of miles there. It's such an important element, I think, and it's really the main reason that our organization has had success in turning around the U.S. union movement to some degree, is because we've been able to bring these real human beings who have very similar struggles to Americans in terms of working conditions, and I mean, they're fighting against privatization. Well, that is a big issue in the American union movement in the public sector, and it has been for many years. You know, the Bush administration has been on a relentless assault against working people. In between war strategy, the working class has been his second biggest enemy. So there were enough similarities in the struggles, as well as the much more horrific conditions that they live under in a war-torn nation with the fear of bombardment, their children terrorized and full of nightmares every night and afraid to go out and play. No potable water, no electricity, all their food now imported. Hashmia, the woman who heads the electricity union, told us that you can't even buy a domestically grown cucumber anymore.
That's
which
outrageous,
grows like a weed in any terrain.
Gosh.
So we've just dismantled everything. So the commonality, the struggles, the humanity, the universality of our humanity, that's what's made the difference in our movement and why we've been able to mobilize union people. God forbid if John McCain is elected president, he's promised us more wars and building that human universality across borders and across oceans and across religions and languages is our only hope for building a sustainable peace worldwide.
Well, you're doing just that now, Kathy, by being in Australia. That was Kathy Black, a convener with the US Labor Against the War. Kathy, that was absolutely illuminating. Thank you for putting all those pieces together for us.
Thank you, Chris. I enjoyed the conversation very much.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Para matarlo, pero él es adivino y entonces no viene. Le ponen trampa para matarlo, pero él es adivino y entonces no viene. Levanta el vuelo por la nochecita cuando todo el mundo se encuentra dormido. Y amaneciendo regresa a su nido, pero en las uñas trae una pollita. Y amaneciendo regresa a su nido, pero en las uñas trae una pollita. Hay mujeres, pongan cuidado, en el gavilán se va. Thank you.
esta polla envenenada. Pero el novino lo dejó burlado, sigue volando sin pasarle nada. Pero el novino lo dejó burlado, sigue volando sin pasarle nada. Dos a dos se las está llevando, según se ve no va a dejar ni una. No tiene pico pero tiene mano, y lo más raro es que no tiene pluma. No tiene pico pero tiene mano, y lo más raro es que no tiene pluma. Las mujeres pongan cuidado, viene el gavilán cebado.
The English translation of that song was "A hawk that gets food from the same place." Kind of appropriate, don't you think? Given that today we're talking about hawkish behaviour, the hawks of war. More about where to find this music later in the program. I'm Chris Richards, and you're listening to Radio New Internationalist, coming to you through radios, computers, and iPods around the world, like the one you're listening to now. And if you want to hear the perspectives of any of today's guests again, or you've missed the earlier parts of this program, just jump onto your computer and visit the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org. Then click on Radio New Internationalist. We've heard a lot about Darfur. Let's go now to a conflict that the United Nations classifies as the worst humanitarian crisis in the Western Hemisphere. The country is Colombia, the gateway from Central America to South America. And for over 40 years, it's been drowning in a civil war that's killing an estimated 3,000 people every year. The conflict started from a simple injustice that has plagued Latin America. Land ownership that was locked up for a minority of wealthy families of Spanish descent, leaving the majority of the population landless and in poverty. In 1964, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, FARC, was officially formed to seize power from the government and redistribute Colombia's land and resources to its people. The government and FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, have been locked in battle ever since. To fund their operations, FARC has morphed into drug dealers and kidnappers, sowing fertile grounds for more assaults and deaths, and to add insult to massive injuries, a system of right-wing paramilitary forces, also funding themselves through drug trafficking, have stepped in to murder and torture those advocating peace, those judicial officers, human rights advocates, and other non-government critics who are challenging their government with words, not guns, to stop the violence. The result? A massive assault on humanity, crippling the people of Colombia and their ability to lead lives free of violence. Elirio Uribe Munoz is a member of a major human rights lawyers collective in the capital, Bogotá. Let's start with a brief overview of the toll of human misery that this conflict is causing Colombia at the moment, Elirio. How many people have fled their homes in fear? This is the real sleeper of an issue in Colombia, isn't it? The amount of displaced people within the country at the moment.
Yes, unfortunately, Colombia is in like the second or third place in the world in terms of internally displaced population. This means approximately 4 million internally displaced people, which represents about 9% of the total population. This internally displaced population has lost their land, their homes, their education, their health care, basically all their rights.
And how many people are murdered on average every year? It's hard for us in the West to get a proper picture of this.
Due to the armed conflict, about 14 people die every day. Of those 14 people, about 6 are combatants, be they members of the guerrilla paramilitaries or the national army, and the other 8 would be civilians. During 1 year, 4,000 to 5,000 people died due to the armed conflict in Colombia. The majority of the civilian population that is killed are peasants, campesinos, indigenous persons, social leaders, trade unionists, judges, human rights defenders, students.
And how many people are disappeared and who are they?
The issue of disappeared persons, well, there are different figures that are handled. The NGO by the name of ASPADES, which is the Association of Relatives of Detained and Disappeared Persons, has a database of 7.5 thousand cases. The Office of the Attorney General of the Colombian government is currently investigating over 6,000 cases, and this 6,000 is only since the year 2000, when the crime of forced disappearance was classified in Colombian criminal code. Although some talk of even 20,000, the persons who are forcibly disappeared have come from a social or political context. They are historical leaders. And as with persons murdered, a similar population is also forcibly disappeared.
So death threats are rampant, arriving in the inboxes of critics of the government. You've experienced death threats before, Illyrio. How does it affect you and the collective of lawyers with whom you work?
In terms of the lawyers' collective and also human rights defenders in general, since 1995 until today, there have been a lot of threats and attacks made against us. Just in the case of the lawyers' collective, over the last 5 years, which corresponds to the two terms of government of the present government of Álvaro Uribe Vélez, we have suffered from over 55 attacks, which have gone from one of our lawyers having their car receiving gunshots, to other members being followed, to appearing in military intelligence reports, to receiving email death threats, telephone death threats, being harassed. So, yes, we at the Lawyers Collective have been affected by all of this, as well as human rights defenders in general. Especially what's important to understand is that our role is to be defending the right of others. And due to the attacks, we have lost some of our capability in terms of protecting the rights of others. And we have also had to work under a climate of fear.
So who's responsible for driving this violence in present-day Colombia?
Well, unfortunately, it has to be said that in part it's due to the state, be it the army, politicians, or paramilitaries, the paramilitaries being extreme right-wing groups with links with civilian and military authorities. Also, the guerrilla has its hand in the conflict, be it the FARC or the ELN. And we also have to talk about another factor that has contributed to the conflict, which is drug trafficking. So many politicians, members of the police, have been involved in drug trafficking. And so, in other words, we can look at the drug economy as encouraging the conflict by creating an economy for it and thus increasing violence.
From the outside, it's very difficult to get our hands on the actors in Colombia. Can you tell us about their agendas and their links? What are they trying to achieve, particularly the paramilitaries?
So the paramilitaries, in theory, were created as private armed groups to operate against the subversive groups. But in reality, they really defend political and economic interests. There's also the interest of political control through paramilitary violence. So they are those who sponsor, you know, those who have benefited from it, those who now control the land of the internally displaced persons. Paramilitaries have also killed over 3,000 trade unionists, over 420 just during the government of Álvaro Uribe Vélez, which, of course, has benefited those enterprises.
Through the work of your collective, you've established that the Uribe government has been supporting the right-wing paramilitaries who are murdering the judicial officers and human rights advocates and peace activists, the critics of the administration. I'm interested in who is funding them. Is there direct links between the Uribe government and the wealthy landowners that actually funds the paramilitaries?
Well, I think there are many different elements that demonstrate the complicity of the government with paramilitary groups. One element would be paramilitary negotiation process carried out by the present government, which has only brought about impunity. Of the 35,000 paramilitaries who have committed crimes, presently, only 55 are deprived of their liberty, and they will soon be free. Second element is what is referred to in Colombia as parapolitics. Presently, there are over 90 parliamentarians who are being processed for their links with paramilitary organizations, and these 90 help support and sponsor both the election and the re-election of the present government. And a third element is that the paramilitary groups made statements and gave orders to support the re-election of the president. And this is seen in the very high levels of votes in the areas of land under paramilitary control. And there are other elements we could also talk about, but due to time right now, we'll just leave it at that.
So the Uribe government, why does it turn on the people who elected it with such violence?
The president says that he is only interested in a policy of democratic security, meaning security for all people. In other words, it's an anti-terrorism policy, that they need to attack the insurgency, and as what he says, those who support the insurgents. It basically follows the old idea of a national security in which there are no rules. And he says that international humanitarian law does not apply. So basically, this is a policy of anti-subversion, which ends up resulting in grave human rights violations.
I'm wondering then, why do the people of Colombia elect Uribe to govern them?
Well, you know, the United States elected and re-elected President Bush. In that country, there is liberty of expression and liberty of press. I think what it comes down to is that there's a lot of control of the means of communication as well as the threat, and that people vote under threat. I think, you know, it's normal to happen under this situation.
I'd like to talk about the role of the United States in propping up this violence. The Bush administration's proposed aid figure for Colombia in the fiscal year 2003 included nearly $500 million in military and police aid alone. So why is the United States doing this? What interest is it seeking to protect?
Well, effectively, you can say the United States is not a good neighbor. When the United States offers military aid, they don't offer cash in hand. Rather, it's planes, it's helicopters, it's uniforms, it's equipment, it's chemicals. In other words, it's good for their industry. Well, there are several factors. One thing that has to be mentioned is that in Latin America, there have been a lot of recent democratic changes, as has been seen in Brazil, Ecuador, Bolivia, Chile, Argentina. Now, the majority of countries are not so under the subjugation of the United States, and Colombia is really the only exception where there continues to be a country subjected to the United States and is an ally of the United States, and also becomes a problem country, and not just for itself, but also for the region. And in that regard, the U.S. can intervene in other countries in the region. And of course, the United States government defends Colombia and through that is able to attack Venezuela and Ecuador and Bolivia and Brazil, the establishment of military bases. And of course, behind all of that, there are economic interests such as oil and mining, petrochemicals. There are many interests. And additionally, the United States has its anti-terrorist crusade. The United States has a list of 28 groups it considers to be terrorists throughout the world. And in Colombia are three of these groups, being the FARC, ELN, and the paramilitary groups. In addition to that, it is said that 90% of the cocaine consumed in the United States comes from Colombia. So then the politicians from the United States are able to use that situation to keep the policy going. But it's really just an excuse for intervention, and they call it Plan Colombia or Patriot Plan. And there are also other military projects that it states in Colombia.
That was very simply and very well explained. I'm wondering about oil. A lot of the violence in Colombia happens around the oil pipelines. What is the U.S. interest in oil in Colombia at the moment?
Of course, there's U.S. interest in the oil, both in Colombia and in the neighboring country of Venezuela. And the U.S. in Colombia has such enterprises as Occidental, but there's also other energy companies, such as in mining with coal. So there's also such companies as United Fruit, now known as Chiquita. And all of these enterprises have supported the war in Colombia. So the U.S. has interests in the oil and the mining. and also other natural resources and investments such as in telecommunications. Presently, the United States has the greatest amount of foreign investment in the country, so you can understand that there's many economic interests from the United States here. As well, of course, there's the whole war industry.
The Colombian government sent troops over its border into Ecuador in March, and the troops killed 20 FARC operatives, including two of its leaders. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez made no bones about what he thought. He said, "Someday Colombia will be freed from the hands of the United States Empire. We have to liberate Colombia." Do you think we can expect regional conflict about Colombia now?
Well, the terms of playing Colombia, one of the fears was that it would bring or would extend the war to other countries. We don't believe that there will be a war with Ecuador or Venezuela, but we do see an impact on the border areas. But, you know, these countries are our neighboring countries, and we don't want war with them, and we don't believe that will occur. Although there are attempts to try to regionalize it, we hope that that will not happen and that Colombia internally will be able to resolve this war, resolve this violence, and that someday we'll be able to overcome this long night of many decades of violence we have suffered from.
So how will the people of Colombia do that? I know that Colombian people are taking the matter to the streets in two street marches in February and March this year. The February march was sponsored by the government against FARC, and it was reported in the Western press it attracted 4.8 million Colombians. The March was against the paramilitaries. What do you think will happen? Are the people of Colombia mobilizing?
In terms of the different marches, I think they reflect a rejection of the violence in the country. To give a positive reading on what occurred recently, in the end, it's showing that we need to be reaching peace processes, humanitarian agreements, to find peaceful resolutions in order to neutralize the violence. The challenge right now is to take advantage of this, to somehow channel these feelings concerning violence that says that that is not a good resolution, that we need to sit down and share words, we need to discuss. What the government has done over the last 5 years is really just try to polarize the population. But hopefully with these marches, we can gain a new awareness that all of the victims are important and that we cannot just continue shooting.
So how many people marched in the March?
Well, according to a spokesperson for the victims' movement, Ivan Cepeda, he is handling some figures which say that the mobilization in March, both in Colombia and internationally, comprised over 6 million persons.
That's a huge amount of people. Are the people of Colombia now turning on the government? Do you think that the Uribe government will be concerned about that? They should be.
Unfortunately, you can say that his popularity has actually risen. Unfortunately, and especially due to the incidents with Venezuela and Ecuador, you can say, you could refer to as a primal nationalism has arisen, which has thus increased the popularity of the president.
What's your view, Alirio, about how the people will succeed in winning peace and when they might do that?
Well, that's difficult to say. You know, I don't handle any type of, you know, futurology. The how for us from the social and human rights movement is that there needs to be a political solution. We need urgent reforms concerning land and land ownership. We need to have a social agenda for peace. The how is not about carrying out violence, is not about a total war policy. We do not believe that the guerrilla will be able to take power as such, nor will the government, as they say, will be able to finish off the guerrilla as they've been trying to do for the last decades. I believe Colombians are tired of violence. Everyone from my generation was born with the war, and war has to end someday. And it's important to remember that those who are killed are not the combatants, but they're the civilians. There have been times in Colombia where over 100 persons are killed a day, but only 4 are combatants. You have to understand that armed conflict only correctly constitutes 5% of times of the deaths. And so there's a whole other gamut of violence that also has to be addressed in order for this conflict to truly end.
One final question. It seems that the United States government has been acting with relative impunity in Colombia. It has not received virtually any international pressure to back off from Colombia in terms of its agenda. Why do you think that's the case, and what will change the international community to take a more active role in asking for peace in Colombia?
Well, it's important for you to understand that when they originally voted for military aid in the U.S. Congress, it only was passed by 4 votes. There was a lot of debate in many sectors, and in many sectors in the United States, they're also against the war in Iraq, and that the Bush era has to come to an end at some point. And we see that recent changes in the Congress and perhaps the U.S. government, well, we hope that it could have a positive change in Colombia. And as far as the European Union or the United Nations or the UNHCR that has been present in Colombia, well, their concern has been more for mitigating the effects of war, providing a humanitarian aid. But they haven't been involved in decisively affecting what causes the violence. So we really hope that that may change in the United States and in other countries. And we also hope that more Latin American countries will become involved decisively in finding a peaceful solution to the violence in Colombia.
That was Alirio Uribe Munoz, a member of a death-defying human rights lawyers collective, the Corporación Colectivo de Abogados José Alvira Estrepo, speaking from the capital of Colombia, Bogotá. David Villa, also from the collective, was translating. Can I thank you both for the time that you've put into today's interview? It was absolutely illuminating. It was a really clear account of a conflict that is so confusing from the outside. Thank you very much, and please do keep up your excellent work. It's very inspiring.
Thank you for your interest as well.
Bye-bye, Alirio. Thank you. Bye-bye, David. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye.
Like David and Alirio, the music that we've been playing tonight also comes from Colombia. It's from the CD Canta Bovia y Su Vallenatos con Alberto Fernandez, celebrating the Colombian style of music called Vallenato. It's usually accordion-led, smiling and sassy, and it's from the Riverboat Records series in the World Music Network's wonderful collection of inspiring music from all corners of the globe. Find out more on the World Music Network's website, www.worldmusic.net, or by visiting the New Internationalist website, www.newint.org, which is also where you'll find copies of this program just waiting to be downloaded onto your computer or iPod.
Radio New Internationalist is produced at 3CR in Melbourne, Australia, and distributed via satellite on the Community Radio Network. Thanks to the Community Broadcasting Foundation for their financial assistance and the Community Broadcasting Association of Australia for sending this program to a wireless near you.
This program's associate producer is Rachel Maher. I'm Chris Richards. Let's talk again next week.